Accession number 27185, reel 64.
Major Barras, reel 64. Explaining about how the plan was made and then sent up, but you didn't get it back.
No, I didn't get it back. I didn't hear anything about it. Actually, it was sent in pretty well near towards my end of my tenure there. Mm-hmm. It would have gone up through my AQMG to the planning committee, which consists of military operations people and others, and eventually finished up on the Chiefs of Staff's committee desk. I did have one thing other than this I had to do, was to justify the withdrawal of hospital ships.
Oh.
Which I was told were going to go anyway. So I had to write up a paper in which the withdrawal of hospital ships. We would then replace them with passenger liners, which would be converted when required.
There were no specific builds.
So there was no. So it was as in the Falklands, there was no particular hospital ship there. There was just a liner which was converted, wasn't there? So I wrote that paper up and sent it up, and it was issued by the Chiefs of Staff without any amendments or anything. It's the proudest moment of my life then.
Do you remember what the arguments in the paper were? How you justified it?
Well, it was merely that in a nuclear war, we were looking at a nuclear war at that time, and it was mainly going to be fought on the mainland of Europe. That hospital ships weren't going immediately to be needed.
Yes.
Hospital ships would probably be needed more overseas in places like Far East Africa and so forth. And as they weren't needed at that time, because we were gradually withdrawing garrisons from overseas, a war in the Far East was unlikely. A war in Africa was unlikely, and also a Middle East. The only thing about the Middle East was the Russians could come down from the north. Mm. They were anxious about keen about the oil fields down there. But that we would have time, if necessary, to have conversions done. Mm. Now, obviously, at that stage, if the Chiefs of Staff had agreed that, and I think I must have done some study with the Ministry of Transport and Civil Aviation about the conversions and how long it would take and which ships could be used and if they'd be available, because you've got to be careful which ship you designated.
It
wasn't sitting in Hong Kong Harbour somewhere. So that was that was the only sort of side job I think I had. The other thing, there was one other thing, which I was secretary of the Joint Movements Coordinating Committee, the JMCC. That consisted of the Director of Movements as chairman, an air commodore from the RAF, from the Air Ministry, and a rather elderly civil servant from the Admiralty. Now, the Admiralty and the RAF weren't so interested in our movements because they had their own movement facilities, so to speak. If the RAF wanted moving anything around, they had the Air Transport Command, Navy had their ships. And so they weren't worried too much, and so therefore their people in charge were of a lower rank. In fact, the Navy didn't have... I think they're all done by civil servants. You know, they could probably get a message. They wanted half a dozen matlows moved to Singapore or something, fix it. And then they sort of come on to us and say, can they go on one of our troop ships? So this JMCC used to meet every 2 weeks in the Ministry of Defence. I was a second secretary. There was a permanent secretary to it.
Who was he?
He was from the RAF. He was known as... I think his surname was Terry. He was a squadron leader. He was part of their administrative staff. And he was permanently based in the Ministry of Defence and did secretarial work.
Yeah.
So he used to be the permanent secretary. And I used to sit, come as his sort of aide, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I'd sit in when he wasn't there. So I had to get to know what was going on. We used to have these meetings once a fortnight, and you'd discuss anything from landing ships, landing craft required up the Persian Gulf, to troop ship programs, anything to do with movements on a sort of global basis. I remember this, sometimes it was always amicably done, and the sometimes there was, the Ministry of Transport and Civil Aviation had a representative on as well, and there were other people that could be subpoenaed on if we needed them from other ministries. But the chap from, I remember the chap from the Admiralty, most of the time discussions were on an amicable basis, and there was no problems at all. Now and again, it got a little sort of, a little bit acrimonious, but not nasty. But on one occasion, I remember, in the heat of summer, it did get a little bit heated. And the chap from the Admiralty had a deaf aid. He used to put this thing on the table, his little box on the table, and then plug in. And listen, you see, and sometimes you had to sort of raise your voice a bit so he could hear what was going on. And on one occasion, he could see he was losing the argument a bit, so he just turned it off. we lost communication with the board, but he just sat back with his arm folded.
Nelson touch.
Yeah, the Nelson touch,
blind
yes.
The telescope.
Yes.
At this time, you mentioned using ships and also using aircraft.
Yeah.
Was there a positive intention to shift from sea transport to air transport where it was possible to do so?
I'm trying to remember now. Well, just talking of the transport situation, the only aircraft we could call on were from the charter companies, which were beginning to grow and were being encouraged by the government, by the way, because it gave them more aircraft in an emergency.
Spare capacity.
Spare capacity, or needed capacity, because BOAC and BEA's aircraft were not available. They were all going to be sent off flying out of the country and out to Australia somewhere, a whole lot.
For what reason?
To get them out of the way. Oh. If there was a nuclear strike, they still wanted, and the hope that they could come back after the place had been cleared up. So I only had the we had the charter company aircraft. The other thing I remember was that there was rumours of going down the Great West Road to a headquarters deep down in Wiltshire somewhere.
What, a sort of reserve bomb-proof headquarters?
Yes, which I believe was actually came out in the press and was made public, wasn't it, about 2 or 3 years ago? And I think sold, actually. It was a place where the government would go. And whether, how many of us would have gone there, I don't know, at that stage. It was so top secret.
Were you aware of any bomb-proof accommodation being available for the staff?
No.
Under the building in Northumberland Avenue?
No, none at all. All the archive stuff was kept down there.
Yeah.
If I wanted to know how many cannonballs were fired at Waterloo, I only had to tell somebody. Yeah. And they could find out. It was incredible. I was impressed with what was called the word escapes me.
Would it be the Army Historical Branch?
No, it's the whole thing. They called it the Westminster machine. What is the word I'm
looking for? Whitehall.
Whitehall machine. Yes, I was terribly impressed with the Whitehall machine. Because if there was a crisis, everybody met and stayed up all night. And a plan could be made out in a day, 2 days, sent up chief staff, agreed, sent to the Defence Committee, agreed, and action.
Did you have many crises like that? Where you had
well, there were one or two, yes, going on, but I wasn't involved. The other side of the QM11, the other bloke would have, and the AQMG between them was
you were doing long-term
handled
planning.
Those. I was just entirely in a global. Of course, the Suez Canal was blowing up at this stage.
That must have made a difference to your planning process if you couldn't count on using the canal as a viable waterway.
Well, it didn't. We were looking at long-term at that time. I wasn't particularly concerned on the short term.
And was it assumed generally for your purposes that the canal would be open to our
would be open in time, yeah. Of course, the rest of the movement's directorate were hard at it because we didn't have much contact with the rest. They were sort of day-to-day movements doing passenger, cargo, long haul, short haul, aircraft and so forth. They have various departments reach. And as the AOR came, of course, under the Director of Movements, but we had very little contact with them, unless I wanted to get some technical information about something, in which case we would get on to them, but not much. And they handled the Suez Canal crisis, which was boiling up at that time.
Yeah.
And in fact, happened that October, I think.
Around about the time you were arriving.
Just about the time I was getting there, yes. The place was like a beehive. When I got there, everybody was running around.
How did you find dealing with civil servants? Because I think this was something new, wasn't it? But,
We had a couple. We had our own civil servants. We had a couple of... Well, but going to our own people, we had two clerks who were civil servants. Who did all the filing. Every single file had a red cross on it and top secret at the top, every file. In fact, when I first got there, I was sitting at my desk and some guy came in and started talking to me about top secrets and I had to sign the Secret Act and that I would be investigated.
Yes, vetted.
Vetted. Mm. I didn't hear any more, so I gathered that they didn't find a double agent in my family anywhere. But I was warned when I left the War Office that I was never to go behind the Iron Curtain into Iron Curtain countries for at least 6 years without permission from the War Office. Who I got permission from, I don't know. But we had two clerks and they handled everything. They were very good, actually. It was Mr. Foster was the one who I remember. There was a little chap called Vaughan Williams, who was elderly, just about to retire. Mm. In fact, had retired. He used to come in every day and sit in the seat and do nothing. Nice little man, Welsh. And then there was another who was a bright spark, who was quite young, actually, probably getting on towards 40, I suppose, who was brilliant at his work, obviously knew more than just filing, ambitious. He was moved on after a bit. Mr. Foster was from the East End of London and very proud of his roots. He was a great chap, great sense of humour. I remember he was a bit older, middle-aged, and was obviously quite content to stay on where he was. But I always remember his, because he was a proud Cockney and loved being a Cockney. And I remember he came in once and he said his father-in-law had come to stay with him from the country. And he used to talk about taties, he said. And he said, taters? Yes, but not taties. Lovely. Yes, I got on very well with him. He was great fun. But he knew his job. He was very good.
What about the chap on the committee?
The chaps on the committee were... Oh, we got on all right with them. They were very cooperative. We weren't too demanding, I don't think. Sometimes I remember when we used to attend meetings where there were quite a lot of them. They used to come. They never appeared in ones.
No.
And I also suspect a lot of them were solicitors. But I remember there was one chap there who used to tie his. I was fascinated watching it because he had a bald head, but a lot. But his hair used to hang down on one side. So he used to tie it over the top of his bald head and not the other side. And I used to watch this during a meeting because it slowly unraveled. And he used to expose his head. He hastily had it tied up again. But that's by the way. no, we got on very well with them. I think it's merely a question of them. I mean, they were used to working with inter-services, inter-departments.
What about dealing with the civilian firms like Pickford's and the other?
I don't think I had any problems with them. I merely wanted information from them as to how many they had, where they were based.
How much could you tell them about what you were doing and why?
Oh, not a lot.
Not a lot.
No, I couldn't tell them why. I mean, I'd just say that if there was an emergency, we might want to use them. Yeah. That sort of thing. I couldn't say that this was all part of overseas planning and that sort of thing.
But were they generally cooperative?
Oh, yeah, they had no problems. They had no problems at all. In fact, we kept up... you used to keep a complete list of what was necessary. In fact, there was most of what I was doing is collecting information most of the time and trying to marry it up together a bit.
Were you responsible for collecting similar information about the availability of resources at the other end of the journey?
Yes, I had some of that as well. Because it wasn't always necessary for me to know it, because there were some airfields where everybody knew who could land. Mm. There were some ports where you knew that alongside depths were okay for any shipping. Mm. It was merely that when we came to use smaller ones and which we needed to get into, that I had to know, and we listed, and then there were only certain ships which could be used. But it was quite an interesting job, actually. We used to go up in civilian clothes. So I had, when I say we had a uniform. I mean, we didn't kid ourselves, we weren't still in uniform, which was bowler hat, stiff white collar, striped shirt, modest tie, a dark suit, a rolled up umbrella, black shoes with shiny toe caps.
Instantly recognisable.
Recognisable, yes. And of course, the sad thing is that towards the end of my time there, my bowler hat fell apart. So I only had the brim and the crown. So I used to carry it. I didn't wear it on the train. I used to carry these two parts up to London with me. And when I got off the train, I used to put the brim on and then sort of gingerly lower the crown on top. The trouble came when I met somebody who I knew was a general or somebody I should take my hat off to. So I had to use both hands. So I had to hold the top like this on the top and the brim with the other hand, take it off like that and put it back on again. I got some pretty curious looks, I must say, from some
of the unorthodox way of raising the hat.
So I must have thought they went, oh, extraordinary chap, I must have him investigated or get the doctors to have a look at him or something. But I eventually finished up... well, it was used as charades, I know, that's why it became a part. And then finished up, and the last day when I went home, it went straight in the dustbin, both parts. So that was the end. Never bought a bowler hat since.
How was it that this was the last part of your life in the army then? I mean, had you been thinking of leaving the army?
No, I hadn't thought about it at all. In fact, if I'd been anywhere else, I would still have been in the army. What happened in 19... Well, it wasn't... let me see, it's 56 I arrived there. It must have been in about a year later, I suppose, that the Sands, Duncan Sands, who was then Minister of Defence, brought out his plan for reducing the armed services and other sort of options for change, and earlier options for change. One of the... one of his requirements was the reduction of officers. And they sent a thing round saying, did anybody want to consider early retirement? Now, it's something I hadn't ever thought of before. And I began to think, well, I got a young family. I'm still under 40. I'm in London, in the UK. In a year's time, I'll be over 40. I'll be abroad somewhere. And I don't know where my family will be. And I thought, well, this is crossroads. Now I've got to make a decision as to whether I stay on and go in for full, wait for full retirement, which would have come at 55, unless by any mischance I got promotion, which would have kept me in. But if they'd done that, I'd have believed that ships with left-hand boots only were sent out by the War Office and during the First World War. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, having had taste of a year anyway at that stage of my young children, I really felt that perhaps I should try and keep them together, keep the family together. That was one of the considerations. The other was, although I'd got recommendation for command, the chances of getting command were getting slimmer every day, with mergers of regiments, the disappearance of colonial East Africa, West Africa, everywhere else those regiments were gone. Admittedly, with a reduction in number of officers, there wouldn't have been so many candidates. And because I'd been on the reserve before, supplementary reserve beforehand, my seniority wasn't very great, so there were quite a large number before me. I thought, well, if I'm passed over for command, and as you probably have heard from a lot of other people, once you get passed over for command, you never get it. If you get passed over for command, you can consider yourself only fit for staff jobs. You would never get a brigade. Well, you'd be very lucky if you got a brigade. You had to command a battalion before you command a brigade and so forth up the line. So if you got passed over, I didn't fancy being passed over, frankly, not from question of personal pride, although I suppose it comes into it a bit, but the fact that I would like to have a commander of a battalion, and if I wasn't going to get a commander of a battalion, I didn't think it was worth staying in. Of course, no one could guarantee one way or the other anything. But I liked the army. I was thoroughly enjoyed my stay in the army. And so, on balance, I thought, well, this is a chance that I'll never have again. If I don't take it now, I'll soldier on. So I sent in my request for early retirement. My fingers crossed and much trepidation.
Had you?
I wasn't at all happy about it, really.
I mean, had you considered what you were going to do in civil life?
No.
You hadn't?
Nothing at all. Absolutely nothing.
So this is a leap into the dark.
It was a total leap in the dark. I don't know whether it was overconfidence on my part that I was, oh, I'm pretty sure I could get something and so forth. Anyway, eventually I got a reply saying they'd been turned down. I wasn't going to, wouldn't accept me. So this is where Nigel Gribben, who I mentioned before,
yes,
came in. He got the job in the Adjutant General's department of handling this side. And he phoned me up. I'm sorry.
Did they give you any grounds?
No, just said it was rejected. However, he phoned me up to explain why. And he said, well, we've got three lists. There are A, B, C. C list are the people who is as good opportunity to get rid of the people who we've been wanting to get rid of for a long time. B are the people who it's touch and go whether we want them to stay or not. A is the people who we want to stay and can't go. And he said, to my total surprise, you are on A list. So I said, that's strange. I then said I was rather keen to go. So I got my teeth stuck into it then. Once I decided I was going, I sort of wasn't willing to let go, so to speak. And then he went away and he came back again. He said, all right, well, if you can get a job in a year's time, which we consider to be a reasonably well-paid job, then we'll let you go.
What were they planning to do with you if you didn't? Did they say what your future was likely to be?
Well, no, it didn't say, but obviously if they were going to keep me in for 16 years, they could hardly keep, that was another 16 years to go, they could hardly keep me in as a major, could they? I mean, they obviously had, presumably had some sort of
colonel's appointment.
Plans for promotion. Mm. I mean, I would have been depressed if I'd spent another 16 years as a major, having been told I couldn't go. I don't think they could have done that. Mm. Unless I'd sort of... They might have given me another job as a major, I don't know. And if I'd made a complete haulics of that, they'd have said, oh, sorry, mate, but you're going to stay a major for the rest of your career. I don't know, but they obviously have plans, I suppose, for promotion of some sort. Anyway, he said, that's what he said. So, he said, we must know within the next 6 months, and then you'll stay on for a further year. So, in fact, at the end of it, I stayed on, I was there for, instead of my normal 2 years, I was there for 2 years, 6 months.
In the same post?
Same post, yeah. Mm. In fact, I did very little for the last few weeks.
How did you go about looking for employment?
Well, I had to think about what was open, what could be open. I thought of perhaps doing something for myself, and I thought, well, that's risky. You can either finish up a millionaire or broke. And if I'd been on my own, I could have probably done something like that. But on the other hand, if I'd been on my own, I wouldn't be coming out of the army, so it wouldn't make any difference.
Quite.
So I decided that I had to get into some sort of organisation which was going to develop and had a future. And I immediately thought of television, not to appear on the screen, I hasten to say, but I thought there must be lots of jobs behind where they needed somebody with administrative and managerial experience. So I wrote round to... I wrote to the top people, and I sent them an original letter in each case, and I think I got someone from the typing pool in the Northumberland house, which we had to use, by the way. We didn't have any typing facilities of our own to do it for me for a little payment on the side. I sent them off to every independent television company. There weren't too many at that time. And the BBC, well, the BBC, of course, wrote back and said, sorry, haven't got any vacancies. In any case, you have to take them through the Guardian if you want to get into the BBC. But I got two positive replies. One was from ABC, and one was from Rediffusion. They had a double name, I can't remember it now. So I went to interviews with them, and ABC were very kind and seemed very interested. And after I'd had several interviews, they said, right, we'd like you to run the studios in Twickenham. And nothing happened for a bit, and then I'd never got a letter of confirmation until I got a letter saying, we're terribly sorry, but the Pilking Committee has been set up to study the whole future of television. And that's going to take several months and maybe a year or so. And we can't guarantee what's going to happen at the end of it. So we're terribly sorry, but we cannot offer you a job at the moment. Well, I needed something within the next 6 months, so that was out. I went to the Daily Telegraph and asked if there was any vacancies on their selling advertisement. I didn't fancy my chances of going as a journalist. I had an interview there, and they said, yep. They said I was a suitable candidate, I think they said, but there were no vacancies at that time. If one came up for the next 6 months, they'd let me know. And although they kept in touch, nothing came up, so nothing came of that. Television Rediffusion, I can't remember what they called, but they ran a television company, but they also had a transport company as well. They were asked to see me, and I saw the managing director, a chap called Beddo, I remember, and he said, well, there's nothing on the television side, but would you consider going into our bus company side? Now, they were called BET, British Electric Traction, and they were a company which had owned most of the private tramways in the UK. When they went and were replaced by buses, they still continued, trolley buses, and coaches. And they owned most of the private bus and coach companies at that time.